It is Tuesday, June 11th, 2024. Hot all over the state of Louisiana, as if you didn't know that already. But welcome back to Talk Louisiana. Jim Inkster is out today. Clay Young is sitting in for him and looking forward to a great conversation with my guests and you. The number, if you don't have it committed to memory already, is 877-217-5757. Our first guest today is John Cuvion, who is a pollster and political analyst, the force behind JMC Analytics and Polling. John and I have had conversations over the years, both in audio and on video, John, on television. We did something recently here with my show with the WAF, with the CBS affiliate here in Baton Rouge, and politics has been something you've been into for a while now. How long?
Yes. Oh, gosh, I would say going all the way back to 1980.
All the way back to 1980.
Man. And I was coloring. I was one of those who, back in the analog days, I would take the old copy of the State Times and color in the election results. I still remember where Edwards Treen, when I colored in East Baton Rouge Parish, and then a year later in the Reagan landslide, I learned that you had these areas like Baker and Zachary and Central that would vote for Edwin Edwards but vote for Ronald Reagan. And so that was like my first political education.
State Times Morning Advocate.
That's dating myself.
We're starting with a throwback in the
like
first minute.
Centroplex and Gotchaws.
I still say Centroplex and catch myself, JC. Well, let's start here in the state of Louisiana with politics. We are on the heels now of Governor Landry's first legislative session, full session. And there were a number of things. This is, of course, after the crime session earlier this year. What grade do you give him?
B+.
B+, really?
So my criteria for what would be an A grade would be if you just basically ran the tables on passing everything. But you'll remember, of course, that the Constitutional Convention idea hit a brick wall called the Louisiana Senate. And what I think this is indicative of, and this to me is the challenge that the governor has, is he's going to basically have to learn to understand what, you know, is important to the Senate, more particularly the Senate President, Cameron Henry.
The rise of Cameron Henry.
That's correct. I would say he really would be the second most important person the second most important person in Louisiana government. The second point one would be, of course, the Commissioner of Administration, Taylor Barrow.
Yeah. B+.
Yes.
Man, I wish I had professors that graded like you. So let's talk about going forward. You referenced this Constitutional Convention, and depending on who you ask, it's either still hanging on or it's a done deal. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
What are you hearing?
I hear a little of both. To me, what the challenge is rather than thinking that you as governor have unilateral power to just force something through, mm-hmm. is understand what the Senate's concerns are with regards to, you know, even having it up for a committee hearing, much less a Senate vote. The other thing which I think is important to appreciate when you're talking about this is, and this to me kind of cuts to the whole of the Landry administration, is it's important to be able to communicate your vision to voters. You'll remember way back in the days of Mike Foster many moons ago, he would have live mic. Mm-hmm. And I think that Governor Landry needs to do something like that, because just thinking that you have an idea in your head and saying, well, hey, therefore it shall be, well, you have 144 people you have to deal with first before your ideas can be reality. And then, of course, there's the other complicating factor, too, of for a constitutional convention, the voters have to approve whatever you want to do. So my attitude is, for this kind of thing, I think this is a challenge for the governor to be able to clearly articulate what he expects the convention to be, because right now, in the absence of any information, all the conspiracy theorists are taking over, and mm-hmm. they're basically painting horrific tales of what could be passed by a convention.
We have some very antiquated laws and financial structures with the way we spend the people's money in Louisiana, and some of those do need to be updated. Some sacred cows should not be so sacred, and some buckets shouldn't always be where they go to get money out of them. How do you balance the need for us to modernize some of our Constitution versus opening up Pandora's box?
Well, you know what's interesting about that, and I will be very careful with how I word this because, of course, I'm not an attorney.
Sure.
But the question then becomes, how much of it do you need a specified constitutional convention for versus what could be simply just changed through statute in the legislature? Because if it's antiquated laws, well, antiquated laws can be changed. Mm-hmm. A constitutional convention, I think of that as kind of like the lightning bolt, where it's like we need something to be done and we just can't get the legislative will to make it happen. let's do a constitutional convention, but that's something you need to clearly articulate that to the voters and make sure it's an item where you have the backs of the voters. Like, for instance, if you want to talk about, choose an extreme example, because it has been referred to, changing the homestead exemption, well, that's the kind of thing that would create such a lightning storm. In my opinion, if you were to even go there, you need to throw in a sweetener such as, well, I could take away the Louisiana income tax if we reduce the homestead exemption down to like $10,000 and index it for inflation. Mm-hmm. But as opposed to just saying, well, I'm going to reduce or eliminate the homestead exemption, that gets a lot of voters scared. So it's those kinds of things, to me, the messaging aspects of it that does need to be addressed if you want this convention to be a reality and, more importantly, voters to approve it.
Clay Young sitting in for Jim Inkster today, talking with John Cuvion, who is a pollster and political analyst, about local politics here. In our next segment, we're going to talk about federal politics, which should be fun as we are just over 2 weeks away from the first presidential debate. I'm sure the Redenbacher company is going to make a lot of money based upon popcorn sales before that one. So, education funding. Right. That's always been one of those issues that people have talked a lot about, and the way that we go about doing that.
Yes.
That is something that if you were able to go back and look at statute and change, people might be in favor of. Correct or no?
Well, you know, the thing about education funding, there is the amorphous blob of quote unquote more money for education versus putting it in concrete terms, which is if you were to take a stroll around the LSU campus, you would see the atrocious condition that some of the buildings are in, which quite possibly are health hazards. That, to me, is how education funding needs to be addressed, as opposed to just throwing more money at it. And I would go a step further and say, when you're talking about education funding, to me, and again, I'm wading into dangerous waters here, but such is life, I think that you really need to have the honest discussion about, well, if these buildings are falling apart and so forth, are we doing what's necessary to do periodic maintenance in the meantime? Because, like, take for example, the LSU library. That thing was horrible when I was there many moons ago, and it's gotten worse to where now you got, you know, water leaking through the ceiling and damaging books. Well, to me, there needs to be the conversation about, okay, LSU, what are you proactively doing to make sure that the campus is in a best maintained condition? So to me, more education funding needs to come hand in hand with accountability, which is making sure that our campuses and other facilities are being adequately taken care of so we don't keep having this, you know, fire brigade every few years.
And the way we deal with insurance companies in Louisiana?
That's an interesting one, too, because you have two extremes. You have the conduct of some insurance companies in the aftermath of the hurricanes that hit Lake Charles really hard versus the fact that if we have rules on the books, and what I've been told, this three-year rule, which basically says you can't drop a policyholder after 3 years, I've been told that Louisiana is the only place in the nation that has such a provision. So if we have those kinds of provisions that are well-meaning but are keeping insurance companies from doing business with our state, well, that to me is the other extreme that needs to be dealt with, because insurance companies are going to come here if they see an opportunity. And of course, coming here means competition, driving rates down. So that to me is something that has to be addressed, which is, what are the anti-competitive things that we have on the laws right now that are preventing insurance companies from coming to Louisiana with all the policyholders we have?
How would you describe Governor Landry's leadership style so far? Having seen him, he's been in statewide office before, but obviously, the light is brighter when you're on the fourth floor of the state capitol. How would you describe his leadership style?
Well, you know, what's interesting is I really see two halves. I see one half, which is I'm seeing him work behind the scenes with various constituency groups, such as when he cut a deal on the congressional redistricting, such as when he cut a deal on more state resources being devoted to crime prevention in New Orleans. That's the good side. The challenge, I think, is basically communicating his vision to voters, because voters are not just going to blindly trust an executive and think that just because he or she proposes it, it therefore is a good idea. So that, and I think the vehicle for doing that is he needs to be able to have some kind of a show or mechanism for getting his views about things out to the voters, as opposed to just these press conferences that you see on the fourth floor.
Well, his interaction with the Senate president from Senate District Number 9 has been interesting.
Yeah.
As of late, I've got about 45 seconds. What do you think about the Henry Landry dynamic?
It's going to be interesting, and it's one where I think there will obviously have to be kind of a meeting of minds at some point, because the Senate president basically has an enormous amount of power when you think that that's basically the last stop before bills can become laws. So you kind of have to understand what it is that's important to President Henry.
President Henry, it's still very, very, very weird to hear. In our next segment, we're going to talk about federal politics. And Louisiana is all over that now, with the House Majority Whip and the Speaker of the House both being from the state of Louisiana. We've got a debate coming up about 2 weeks from Thursday, which will be very interesting. Could actually be the decider, depending on how that goes, on what's happening in November. We'll ask John about that. And he referenced redistricting. What's Garrett Graves going to do? I wonder if JMC has thoughts on that. I bet he does. And Adonica Duggan joins us after the bottom of the hour. That's Radio Guy Talk for after 9:30. You know, we could have sold admission for the during commercial break conversation between John Cuvion, who is my guest. I'm Clay Young, sitting in for Jim Inkster on Talk Louisiana. The signature support is from the Office of Mayor President East Baton Rouge Parish, and the show originates from the Investar Tower here in Louisiana's capital city, Baton Rouge. John Cuvion is the force behind JMC Analytics and Polling. And John, we went into break talking about federal politics, but I want to jump to one of the other things I said first. House District 6, which includes three or four different cultures in Louisiana.
Yes.
As you look at it. Looks like this map will stay. Yeah. No.
For now.
Okay. For now.
Yeah.
What's Garrett Graves going to do?
So Congressman Graves has three choices. And, you know, just basically from what I see, from what people have been talking about and so forth. The first choice is staying put in the current 6th district. Mm-hmm. Now, that is a district that has been redrawn to where it basically goes down I-10 and up I-49 to Shreveport.
Yeah.
It has a 55% black voter registration majority. It supported Joe Biden 59-39. It also gave John Kennedy 46% of the vote. So in other words, it has a Republican voting base. That Republican voting base is not 50%, however. And then, of course, there's the Cleo Fields, state senator here in Baton Rouge, will be running. I would expect some other black legislators will jump in the race as well. It'll be a crowded race. So that's kind of the first choice for Congressman Graves, is the as-is of just running in the district number the 6th, even though politically it's much less friendly. The second option is if he were to – the 5th congressional district now has moved into South Baton Rouge. And the question would be, would Garrett Graves do that? Well, there's a couple of very major challenges with that route. This is a Republican district, it's true, but only 39% of the district is East Baton Rouge and Livingston Parishes. The rest, of course, goes all the way up to Northeast Louisiana, which is where a sitting congressman, Julia Letlow, currently resides.
Yeah.
And there's also the personal factor of the late Luke Letlow and Garrett Graves were good friends, and that would be just a very nasty, ugly race. So that's kind of unpalatable alternative number two. Unpalatable alternative number three, since you do have pieces of the 3rd congressional district, which is currently represented by Clay Higgins, that district got stretched further down the coast to include Terrebonne and parts of Lafourche Parish. And there has been chatter about whether Congressman Graves would run there. And even though that would be a very challenging race in a Republican district, the one thing that perhaps may be on Garrett Graves' mind would be the fact that between the fact that St. Mary Parish is in the East Baton Rouge, the Baton Rouge media market, and the fact that Garrett Graves has represented Terrebonne-Lafourche parishes before, 24% of the current, the new 3rd district, quote-unquote, knows Garrett Graves. So in other words, he has a bit of a head start in that part of the district. And then in Lafayette Parish, where you have the more higher-income precincts in that district, there's question about whether the business community there has ever really cottoned to Clay Higgins. And then finally, they put the most Democratic parts of Calcasieu Parish in the Clay Higgins district, while Mike Johnson got the more conservative parts. Mm-hmm. So those four pieces to me are probably, I don't want to pretend to know what goes on in Garrett Graves' mind, but those could be the considerations that he is weighing about whether he would run against Congressman Clay Higgins as the quote-unquote more moderate candidate. But of course, that's all speculation, but that I suspect would be kind of the considerations he has for the three choices available to him.
Higgins is popular in his district.
He is.
And Senator Fields here has been pretty pristine in his political maneuvering since getting back to the legislature.
Yes.
It's all interesting. As a Louisianan, specifically as an African-American Louisianan, I was annoyed by the difficulty it took to do something that we have to do based upon the reflection of our population. Right. Years ago, the irony of Cleo Fields running is he lost his seat because of this same sort of thing.
Yes.
And I think in 2024, just the floundering that went on over something that we need to do. I mean, we literally have a district that includes Caddo and East Baton Rouge Parish.
Yes.
Two areas that could not be more different.
And it's eerily reminiscent of the 4th Congressional District that he represented in the, it was like 1994, 1995 time frame that the Supreme Court back then struck down.
If you were, and I don't want to get into you giving advice to anyone, what would you say the smart money would be?
Oh, Lord. That's that, because you basically have three equally unpalatable alternatives.
Yeah.
The path of least resistance would be to run in the 6th district and, you know, work the rest of the district outside the Baton Rouge media market hard. Mm-hmm. But that would require peeling away about 20% of the black vote. So there's no good choices in these three possible districts that Garrett Graves would, you know, have to run in. And I wouldn't even pretend to know, you know, what calculations are. I'm
sure.
Just basically saying from a data perspective, that's the pros and cons of each of those three districts.
What about the role of the relationship between our governor and incumbent District 6 representative? That played a part in this as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that was even overtly discussed in trial, was that, you know, that was the political purpose behind drawing the district, because you have this delicate tap dance going on where if it's drawn explicitly for racial reasons, there's a much higher level of scrutiny applied. But if it's drawn for political reasons, courts don't want to touch that. And so that was the angle that they tried to, I guess, speak about during the trial in Shreveport, was that, oh, this was drawn for political purposes.
It's going to be interesting to watch. We have a pretty interesting political fall on the way.
Yes.
Led at the top of the ticket by President Joe Biden and what looks to be presidential challenger, former President Donald Trump, who's fresh off his trial. What's your take on that level of politics now?
I think it's going to be an interesting and lively race. A couple things I think that need to be brought forth to your audience, because it's certainly not being talked about in the media. Mm-hmm. The Trump conviction was, from a polling standpoint, a big nothing burger. More specifically, the average poll numbers only changed 0.4% in the week after the conviction was handed down. Mm-hmm. And the way I look at it is, for something like that, where you would think that talking about a 34 times convicted, you know, former president would create this big, like, electoral downdraft in President Trump's chances, it did not.
What do you think a supporter of former President Trump learned that they didn't already expect, which probably reflects why the numbers didn't move that much?
And I would suspect that basically this is where the political talking heads, so to speak, get it very wrong.
Yeah.
Is Donald Trump is a very defined figure. And so basically think – what I see happening is what I would say a lot, and this is using social media jargon because I have this bad habit of being on Twitter a lot.
Careful now.
The hopium that is being ingested by the Biden campaign, where they're thinking –
The hopium.
Hopium.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. We'll dig into that during the commercial break, but go on, finish your point.
That if, you know, XYZ happens, it's going to derail the Trump candidacy. Well, I've been hearing that kind of hopium ever since the Access Hollywood scandal, or really – even before that, where with each new Trump outrageous remark, oh, yeah, well, because he said this and this about Jeb Bush, that, you know, that's going to do his candidacy in. Well, each one of those instances barely moved the poll numbers, and he does have a solid base of support. And so that's where I think the Biden campaign is seriously miscalculating, is I think they were truly hoping there would be this, you know, kind of procession of convictions that would beat him down. And, well, it looks like there's only going to be one trial, which is the one that was just completed.
Yeah, yeah.
That's going to be held between now and Election Day. And, of course, that's going to be appealed. So, meanwhile, you have an election season to happen.
Yeah. It doesn't appear that his base saw anything that would deter them, because they either do not believe some of the things said about him or don't care about
Correct.
The other things said about him. So politically, it just didn't move the needle, and I didn't really expect it to.
Right. I mean, basically what you're talking about is Monica Lewinsky plus $130,000.
That's one way to look at it. All right, John, tell people quickly where they can find you.
So I'm on social media. At WinWithJMC is my handle. I like to talk about all things political in a nonpartisan way, of course. And then WinWithJMC.com is my website. And I'm going to have an article in the next day or two where I'm laying out the presidential races as I see it.
All right, let's talk education on the other side of the break with Adonica Duggan. Back with more Talk Louisiana in just a moment. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from the Office of Mayor President East Baton Rouge Parish, and the show originates from the Investar Tower here in Baton Rouge. Clay Young sitting in for Jim Inkster, and my guest in this second half hour is the great Adonica Duggan with the Baton Rouge Alliance for Students. Before we get into what we're going to discuss, tell people what the Baton Rouge Alliance is.
We are an education advocacy organization focused on public education in Baton Rouge, and our focus is making sure that the voices of families and students are heard in the conversations around how they're served. So.
We just spoke with John Cuvion about the legislative session that just ended. From your perspective as it relates to education, what grade did you give the session?
You know, it's a mixed report. There's a lot going on in education, and I think that the outcomes we'll see them over the next few years. There's definitely a lot of changes in the state, and we'll see how those things shake out. But in general, I would say we should certainly keep an eye on education. For those of us who have spent a lot of our careers really working in this field, there's a lot of attention in this moment, and there's just a lot of work to do, frankly.
If you'd like to talk with Adonica, you can give us a call at 877-217-5757. You and I were speaking during the commercial break about the funding conundrum that surrounds education, both at the state level, but then in local districts. And I expressed to you some frustration with the fact that a district like Baton Rouge, East Baton Rouge Parish, which has a nearly $800 million annual budget when you include all of the funding, and there's often a struggle to get the dollars into the classrooms or into a teacher's paycheck.
Yes, what? Into a teacher's paycheck,
yes,
right?
Yes.
We all know that the most important thing for student outcomes is having a great educator in front of them every day.
Yeah.
And then we tend to, at a district level, start to, make those investments as the last thing that we're putting in our budgets. Mm-hmm. And so right now, EBR is in the middle of a budget cycle, and we see all of this talk about how we're going to prioritize educators, but then it's the last thing that we start to do, right? And so I think that there is a mismatch between what our values are on how we serve kids and the things that we know are important and how we're making investments in those things. If you think the most important thing that you need to do is pay your teachers well, mm-hmm. then you start with that, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you've got colleagues all over the state of Louisiana. If you were looking across our state, who's doing it well?
I think we've seen some interesting things out of districts like Jefferson Parish where they've incentivized educators. I know Ascension just recently mm-hmm. approved a raise. Mm-hmm. I think it is really about how you are incentivizing educators to do the most difficult work
yeah.
and how you are rewarding performance and how you are making sure that you're making investments in recruiting the talent and retaining the talent that you need in front of the kids every day. And I don't think that there's an apples to apples comparison because, large urban school systems have different challenges than rural school districts. But I think that there are examples both in the state and across the country of people who prioritize talent in a way that we should be thinking about in EBR.
Adonica Duggan runs the Baton Rouge Alliance for Students and is our guest in the second half hour of today's show. Tell me about education savings accounts.
Oh, there is so much to talk about here, Clay.
All right.
I think, in general, we feel like making sure that parents have control over how they are spending the resources that were dedicated to educating their children mm-hmm. is an important and, an good investment for our state. That said, when you have a significant restraint on the amount of dollars that you have to be able to serve students, we think it's really important that you know, those education savings accounts come coupled with two things. Accountability. So if you're taking public dollars, you need to be accountable for how those students are performing. And I know that you and I are going to have a conversation about all the stuff going on with accountability in the state later. But also prioritizing our most underserved students. You know, we have kids in this state who don't have access to a high-quality school, and they should have first right of refusal at those dollars if we're talking about getting them out of the lowest-performing schools in the state. And so we're hopeful that we'll see things out of the State Department of Education that, you know, align with those values as we start to see the implementation of the Louisiana Gator program.
There is sometimes a gap between legislation like this and the public's understanding of what it is. And I'm not making any derogation about the people of Louisiana, but things get wonky and people don't often know, okay, what does this do for me? How can you translate the impact of this to the average average person, particularly those who are in those areas, those disinvested areas where education is even more important?
Yeah, it hopefully increases the access to high quality schools. And, you know, implementation is, like you said, the gap between what happens at the legislature and the way that those things get implemented, both at a state and local level, are really, for us, the things that we wake up thinking about every day. Because there are often times when a legislator is seeking to answer a challenge of their constituents, which is like, hey, I don't have access to a high quality school. And there's unintended consequences of that in the long term. So making sure that the intentions of the legislation actually reward families and shake out in ways that serve our students better and don't have unintended consequences, whether they are financial or whether they are not serving the kids that you intended to be serving better. Those are the things that we really focus on and make sure that, you know, we're keeping our eye on how these things get implemented in a way that makes sense.
Louisiana has seen in certain districts like EBR and Caddo Parish an increase in charter schools as an option, another public school option, because charters are public schools. Where do you grade the charter landscape right now in 2024? Because in years gone by, there was even more resistance to charters coming into a district.
Yeah, I think in terms of the performance of the schools, I would say it's a mixed bag.
Okay.
I think, you know, there is no silver bullet in education. Well, you know, we have high performing charters, we have high performing traditional district schools, we have low performing charters, and we have low performing district schools. For us, you know, we think schools that serve students well should remain open. Schools that don't serve students well should be closed. And when you have charters that aren't performing, you'll see, as in the case of IDEA, which was a very, you know, public transition, those schools make adjustments, and hopefully we'll start to see the same things with, you know, traditional district schools.
Oh, you see, that's exactly where I was going. So it always seems easier with a charter to say, eh, this is not working, not efficient, the kids aren't learning, the operation isn't right, and then the change has to happen, and it typically happens relatively
quickly.
Mm-hmm. With traditional schools, not so much.
Well, so schools are emotional, right? Yeah. I say all the time, like, you know, I'm a McKinley High grad.
Yeah,
we feel strongly about our schools.
Yes.
We love our schools,
yes.
You know, and, you know, we have strong emotional ties. Everyone has had an experience with schools, whether they love their experience or whether they were challenged by their experience. Mm-hmm. People have strong emotional feelings. And so often this is not an intellectual conversation about how the schools are serving the needs of students and families, but rather an emotional one. And also, schools are a big and important community anchor.
Yeah.
And I don't think that we can underestimate the role of making sure that those community anchors stay stable in communities that are already underserved in a lot of ways. And so I think you have to have smarter, more efficient ways. We've learned a lot over the years in how we think about, you know, investments in communities and how we think about the role of schools in communities. And I hope, you know, as we start to see changes with the new administration in EBR, that we'll learn some of the lessons of the past.
You know, I call her an education maverick because she is pretty fearless. She's Adonica Duggan. She runs the Baton Rouge Alliance for Students. Paul is in Opelousas and is on with us at 877-217-5757. Go, Paul.
Yes. Yes, sir. How you doing?
Doing fine.
And to your guests, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just a question. Just a simple numbers thing. Most parents want to send their kids to a great school.
Sure.
Let's just face it. Most parents do. Some don't have the physical ability to from transportation. If you had a normal school of 1,000 kids, all right, and everybody had an account and went to a higher performing school, we know physically that school can't take 1,000 kids tomorrow. So they're going to bounce back. So you're going to be stuck with, to me, my opinion, with having to invest in that poor performing school and make it a higher performing school. Mm-hmm. But just those analogies, do you agree with that, or do you think I'm way off base, that everybody can't go to a high performing school tomorrow and there's not enough teachers out there to perform?
Thank you, Paul. And to Paul's point, if the number of high performing schools is limited and parents are going to want to rush into there, absolutely, like a great restaurant, that's actually a fair point. What's your response to that?
I think that there is no one answer, and you have to be doing multiple things simultaneously, okay, right? And so to Paul's point about investments of resources, what we typically see is that investments of resources in our lowest performing schools aren't what they should be. Mm-hmm. And so instead of concentrating our resources with the students who need them most at a district level, we're concentrating our resources with the students who have the most means.
Yeah.
So you have to be doing both. You have to be thinking about, how do I make sure that the schools who are serving the most needy populations of students, mm-hmm, have the resources that are and the intention to improve the outcomes there. So the highest performing educators, the most investments in facilities, the most resources concentrated around serving those students' needs. And then also in the short term, allowing students to have the option of going to another school.
Before we take a break, let's talk to Patrick, who I believe is here in the Baton Rouge area. Patrick, you're on with Adonica Duggan. Go ahead.
Hey, so if the students and the parents are trying to get into the good school, wouldn't that mean then that the students and the parents would have to compete to get in those good schools? And would that be a good or a bad thing that students compete to get into the good schools?
Interesting question. Thank you, Patrick. What about that?
Well, the way that it works in charter schools is that they have an open enrollment lottery system. Yeah. And I anticipate that this will be much the same, which is that, you know, you have a chance. It's unfortunate that we have to give out golden tickets for the best schools in our cities and our state. But, you know, certainly it also creates pressure on local school systems to up the bar. What we see in communities where you have increasing options is that the quality of all schools improves. And so that's the goal, right?
But, if you kind of what Patrick is alluding to, what Paul was saying, but in the business world where I come from, the market will dictate what you get. And if you want to survive in the market, you've got to perform at a certain standard. And there's a little less of that in some areas of government where you get the money no matter what.
That's right.
And there is no more important investment we can make than that in our children. And in our next segment, I'd like to talk with you about that. I think we are evolving into a place where more people are understanding if you invest in children early childhood education, what they get at what age they are literate and staying there, that it has a positive impact on everything: quality of life, public safety, employable talent. I mean, it's just ground zero for success. We're talking with Adonica Duggan with the Baton Rouge Alliance for Students, and we'll talk more with you after the break. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. Clay Young sitting in for Jim Inkster. My guest is Adonica Duggan with the Baton Rouge Alliance for Students, an education advocacy organization here in Louisiana's capital city. I want to remind you that signature support is from the Office of Mayor President, East Baton Rouge Parish, and our show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. I've known Jim a long time, and this building's evolved a lot. I've been here before. It's been a little while. Adonica, let's go back to the phones here. Let's talk with Stuart, who is in the Baton Rouge area. Hey, Stuart, you're on with Clay Young and Adonica Duggan.
Clay, Adonica, and the audience, good morning.
Morning.
To both of you related to this educational issue. As a taxpayer, first of all, most conscientious taxpayers are disgusted at the exorbitant amount of money that the state of Louisiana expends on a per-pupil basis for the results that we're receiving. Mm. I think we need to go to some boot camp type style schools, because school is there. I'm a former frontline public education practitioner. I know the landscape firsthand. Schools are not bad. When a school possesses a population that has not been validated by education and doesn't value and respect this beautiful gift called education. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you, Stuart. We appreciate it. Want to give Adonica a chance to answer before getting to the next call. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say this. I don't think that any mother or any family wakes up and doesn't want the best for their kids.
Sure.
I think that we all have different different tools in how we go about getting that. And so, I often kind of bristle at this talk about people not caring about education. I think people are doing the best that they can. And I think that that shakes out in different ways. And I think that is incumbent upon the folks who are doing this work to make sure that we are serving students well. We've known for generations that it's very difficult to serve some students. And, you know, we like to make excuses about why we're continuing to not serve those kids well.
I could not agree with you more. And I often compare a teacher in a classroom to a law enforcement officer on the front line. We should think of teachers in many of the same ways as we think of police officers, because teachers are really one of those first gatekeepers into a child living his or her dreams, the classroom environment. And sometimes the way we discuss educators, look, there's nothing wrong with someone wanting to make a livable wage to do what they're doing for a living, especially when they're an educator.
Absolutely. You know, I come from a family of educators. My mother is a retired educator. She went to work in a classroom my entire life. And, you know, I grew up around that. And I truly believe it is a call on your life.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we have to respect educators and we have to give them the tools that they need to be successful, because this is really important community building work. You and I talked offline about, you know, a lot of the problems that we have in communities start and end with how kids are prepared to live the lives of their dreams.
1,000%.
Yeah.
So we're talking with Adonica Duggan. You can get in this last segment at 877-217-5757. Carol is in the Baton Rouge area. Hey, Carol, good morning.
Yes. My daughter went to school. I think the kids her age went to 4 different high schools in my neighborhood, That is public high schools. Mm-hmm. I'm counting all the Catholic schools and stuff.
Sure.
And it served my daughter well. Will this be affected by all this stuff they're talking about?
Which specific stuff?
Voices in East Baton Rouge Parish.
Well, which specific stuff are you talking? Are you referring to, Carol?
The savings account.
Oh, the savings account. All right. Thank you, Carol. Specific to that. It would be a statewide thing.
It will be a statewide thing, and then families will have the option if they wanted to participate in the program.
Yeah. Stewart made reference to the MFP formula, and that was a point that I don't want to miss. He talked about people being disgusted, not that we are spending so much on students, per student education, but the results that we're getting based upon what we're spending. What about accountability for that factor as well?
Yeah, you know, I think what's interesting about that is people who do this work often take for granted that people are disgusted.
Yeah.
I think the vast majority of people aren't aware of how disgusted they should be.
Yeah.
You know, I've shared with you, we've looked at like national data, you know, and also even down to the state level in Louisiana, something like 80 plus percent of kids, families think that their kids are reading on grade level. And that really actually that number is closer to 30. And so people aren't aware of how disgusted they should be with how we are investing in education and what our outcomes look like.
Say that stat one more time.
Yeah. So it's, I think 80 plus percent of students, let's see,
84%
of families believe that their children are reading on grade level. And actually it's closer to 37%.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Think about that. Specifically in communities of color, because everyone talks about crime. And if you don't invest there, if a child doesn't have a pathway to employment and doing something productive, they end up doing something else, which is why these things are not equal in terms of the need for investment. I'm not saying you don't invest in children, but if you have a hole in your roof, you don't go buy a new car.
Absolutely. And I will say this, Clay, like those numbers are even worse in communities of color.
Sure.
And frankly, you know, we have this, you know, disconnect between how we serve our children and what is going on in our communities. Mm-hmm. And if you are not preparing someone for the life of possibilities,
sure,
they will have bad options, and so they will make bad choices because they will be the only choices that are there to be made. And so, like, all of these things are interconnected in the ways that we serve communities and the ways that we want to improve quality of life in our cities.
Do you see this evolution in, say, 15, 20 years ago, it was only push kids to 4-year institutions. Mm-hmm. And within the last decade, we've seen a softening of that to people motivating children towards employment. Say BPSI and Bossier Parish or Baton Rouge Community College in Baton Rouge and some of these 2-year institutions that can get you into a job within a year.
Yeah.
And then you always have the option to go to an LSU, a Southern, or wherever. Has it evolved enough for us seeing that we should push kids to job readiness first?
I don't know that, you know, we want to start making decisions for families because sure. we know that when we incentivize districts to do that, sometimes the outcomes don't shake out in ways that are equitable. And so you want to be really careful about that. But you also want to say, whatever the choices that you make for your future, we want to make sure that you're prepared for the life okay. that you want for yourself. Awesome. And we don't want to make that decision as educators early on. You know, we don't want to start making that decision with fifth graders or eighth graders sure. or whatever. But we want people to be prepared with a lot of options. And for some students, that is making sure that they have a post-secondary option that gets them closer to work, right?
Let's talk with Charles in Madisonville. Charles, go.
Yes, I just moved from Baton Rouge recently. One reason, you know, the obvious all the problems. But in my subdivision, they built a brand new school, which is now in St. George, you know, saying this is going to be a neighborhood school. It's not. In my opinion is that we destroyed our whole education and community system by having all this busing and putting people in schools that are not in their neighborhood.
What about that? Thank you, Charles. What about that?
Yeah, Charles, I appreciate that sentiment, and I think having the option of a high-quality school in every neighborhood is something that we should strive for.
Yeah.
I also think the unintended consequences of that, because of the way that our cities are laid out, result in resegregating our city,
mm-hmm.
right? And so if we want to resegregate our schools, we can certainly, you know, have that conversation. But yeah. I think that those are the unintended consequences of the way that our cities are laid out and the way that our neighborhoods look, right?
Well, you and I have talked about in Baton Rouge, for instance, their kids catching the bus before 6 a.m.
Yeah.
And that's not acceptable.
It's tough. And, you know, I think that, you know, you don't want to take that option away from families who think that that is going to get them to the best quality school. That's, you know, I have 4 kids and they all yeah. need different things in their schools.
Yes.
And so, you know, if you think that the best option for little Johnny is across town, we sure. want you to have the option sure. to be able to take advantage of that. But if you want to be able to send your kid to a school that they can walk to or that they can, you know, you can drop them off on your way to work, you should have a great school in your neighborhood that allows them to do that as
Tell
well.
Tell people where they can follow and find the Baton Rouge Alliance if they want to read more about the work
sure.
you're doing.
Sure. BRAlliance.org or BRAlliance Action.org.
Are you optimistic, pessimistic, or undecided about where we're headed?
I'm always optimistic.
I knew you were going to say
that. Wherever human beings are, we are both disasters and miracles, right?
Well, listen, it's been a blast talking with John Cuvion and Adonica here, filling in for Jim. It's been a little while since I did live radio, and I'm what I am because of the people on the other side of the glass that kept this thing out of the ditch.
Right.
It's been fun. You guys enjoy the rest of your week. I'm sure Jim comes back. Is he back tomorrow? He's back tomorrow. Look out. Here he comes. The Baton Rouge Alliance for Students here in the Capital Region and JMC Analytics and Polling. John will be covering what's happening both statewide. He's talking about some local districts, and he's got some thoughts on the federal politics, too, which has been quite entertaining. And I think that's all I'll say about that, so Jim doesn't have a revolt on tomorrow's show. I remember, again, signature support is from the Office of Mayor President, East Baton Rouge Parish. And this show has originated from the Investar Tower here in Baton Rouge. You guys enjoy the rest of your Tuesday.